Accession number 32299, reel 5.
Tom Rees, reel 5.
Okay, well, after we'd been promoted to a midshipman officially and got our uniforms from Gieves, the very first thing we did was went on a thing which we call the knife, fork and spoon course, which was essentially to teach us the various best way to conduct ourselves at various odd functions, such as dining, using the right knives and forks, wine, and etc., etc. For this, we went to the Royal Naval College at Greenwich, and we used to dine in the Painted Hall, and we were taught all sorts of things about the Navy, the history of the Navy and tradition, and how you should behave, and how to get on board small boats. For instance, you learn that if you're waiting to go using a boat to get away from the ship, the senior officers always get in last, and they get off the small boat first. Something which is essential, otherwise you might get your a dirty look if you make an error in that respect. And of course, it's very nice to know how to behave and how to what goes on at cocktail parties, etc., etc., etc. Because we were all very young. We were all I was by this time I was still 18 or 19, just 19, I suppose. Yeah.
How impressive is it to be at in sort of the Painted Hall at Greenwich?
It's absolutely fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. The Who's great paintings all over the place, and the whole air there. Good, it's a very, very famous place. I don't know what they use it for these days, but it's an internationally important place. And we were very fortunate to be there. I think we spent about 3 weeks there, or something of that sort. I can't remember, but I've got no record of it in my logbook. But it was a good time.
And again, that to reinforce your officer role within the Navy.
Yes, there was no formal seamanship training. It was just purely and simply how a naval officer was a representative of the British abroad, how he was to behave in the presence of foreigner, how he carried out relationships and all the rest of it, with all these places which we were bound to go to at one time or another, the history of the Navy and all about Nelson and the general life, how to conduct yourself, how to I don't know. I don't know, really. How to behave as a gentleman, I suppose, really. There we are.
And was it useful?
It was very useful, yes. Because, you see, first of all, when I, from a teenager, well, even when I was young, I was never going to formal balls when I was a youngster, but even when I was a teenager, a Selby couldn't do anything like that because it was all rationed, and the thought of sitting down to a formal dinner with crystal glass and decanters and the sitting and the, of course toasting the king, it used to be, with sitting down in the wardroom, because we didn't stand up and we were told why that would be. You banged your head on the bloody deckhead, etc. And we learned all these things, and it affected my whole life and the way I behave even to this day. I think some people might say I'm a bloody ass and whatnot, but I feel that it was a very good education, very good.
What was the next step after that?
After that, we had to start the serious work, and first of all, we had to learn how to fly in the British weather conditions, which are totally different from America, where they've got all the frontal systems here and all these the low clouds, and you never can tell. And in those days, of course, as well, it was all very difficult. With we might have to let down through cloud and whatnot, and the wireless radio direction finding and all that sort of thing was at its base minimum, and they could easily let you down, said steer 090 and make you fly into a hill or something or a mountain, because they got the reciprocal bearing wrong, because they were doing it by hand and manually. They were all learning it, so it was difficult. So we went there to learn about instrument flying at Hinstock, Naval Advanced Instrument Flying course there. And that was for I don't know how long that was for. December through to the middle of December through to the middle of January in 1956. I do remember that was a bloody cold winter, and we were with some Canadians and whatnot.
With that, what did that involve then when you were on that course?
It involved instrument flying. But pure instrument flying.
That was all it was?
All it was, instrument flying, yeah. And going out and having a general look around, basic map reading. But don't forget that if you look down at the ground from England from here and compare it with the spaces where we've been flying in Canada, there was only one town every 40 miles in Canada. But here the place is littered with small little villages and roads and all sorts of things. So you had to get yourself clued up there.
And I take it during that period it was probably pretty poor weather as well, was it?
Well, it was pure. It wasn't good weather at all. No, well, it wouldn't be. Of course, but that was middle of December to the middle of January, just like the weather we've just been having, actually. About the same degree of coldness as well.
And what aircraft did you do that?
That was in a twin engine aircraft. I think that was in Oxford, yes. And there was one trip in a Harvard there, I see. But on the Link, so that was on Oxford.
So with the Oxford, was it then a dual control thing that you were playing on instruments, or were you?
No, yes, it would be the Oxford was dual. I wasn't qualified at that time to fly twin engine aircraft, and but the whole object was for me to be blindfolded, as it were, with the screens, and take the second pilot's position and fly on instruments, which is what I did. I didn't finish that course. I had to go into hospital, and I missed it. And as a result of that, I had to go back and get some more beard. I had to go down to Leon Solent just to see flight. To fly with this chap, CPO Jaggard, Chief Air Officer Jaggard. He was a nice fellow. And he gave me all the basic refresher course on how to fly in England on single engine things, because I'd missed the course because I was in hospital for a short time.
What was the problem?
To be honest, I'll tell you, I was circumcised. The problem down there. It's all right now, but I was having difficulty.
But it was a non-flying
thing. Non-flying thing, yeah.
So at that stage, you have to do a refresher course just to get your back at it.
Yeah, because even nowadays in the military, well, it wasn't until I left the military, if you were going on leave and didn't fly for 2 weeks, the very first flight after you got back, it was always a refresher flight. You were never tossed into the full works, unless there's a war on. I mean, in Korea, we stopped thing for 2 weeks, but the very first flight you'd be off on. But that's a different kettle of fish. No, it's much safer because you can if you do it every day, it's fine. It's like playing cricket, I suppose. If you go away for a while and you try and pick it up again, it's much better to play day after day or fly day after day. It's no problem. And that went on until what are we talking about? That
was May. The refresher was.
Oh, that's right, May. That's right. Yeah. And in June the 3rd, we went up to place called Rattray in Scotland. Have you ever heard about that? Now, Scotland, Rattray is Royal Naval Air Station Rattray, it's the northeast of Scotland, and it was the operational flying school. It was the commanding officer was a Royal Marine officer, and we flew Fireflies. Now, I hadn't flown a Firefly, so I had my first four flights there were all familiarization flights. And Rattray is in between, just north of Aberdeen. There's the two fishing ports called Fraserburgh and Peterhead. And you know Scotland's like this, and the Murray Firth is up here, and you go out there and it comes down here to Aberdeen and Edinburgh, and it was right on the corner up there. It's mentioned on the weather forecast sometimes, Rattray. And that was lovely. It was a wartime place. completely isolated, miles away from anywhere. They had a crew of Wrens there, but we were the last course there. We actually, when we finished our thing, Rattray was closed down, and we all moved down to St Mirren, Padstow, which is a big airfield near where that fisherman, that restaurateur,
Rick Stein.
He's taken it over now, I think. At any rate, that was Rattray, where we learned how to fly on all these things: close formation, aerobatics, familiarization, forced landings, quarter attacks, aerobatic check, interceptions, open formation. We've mentioned all these aerobatics again. Open formation. See, there's a lot of this work. Follow the leader. We've mentioned aerobatics, fixed ring firing. This was the actual quarter attacks on aircraft, where you're using the gun sight ring, not the Don Gyre thing, and you're coming down and you're laying out and sort of attacking him as if we were attacking an enemy bomber, and that was it. Then that was up until July.
Can I ask your impressions of,
go ahead,
of the Firefly,
yeah,
aircraft? What you thought of it and how it handled?
The Firefly was one of the few aircraft that was actually, there was a new aircraft made by the Ferry Aircraft Corporation, twin engine, a twin seat aircraft, had an observer in the back, and the pilot in the front, and it was more of a bomber type interception place. It had aircraft. The fighters at this time were the Seafires, which is the naval development of the Spitfire. Now that's basically what it was, and we learned how to fly the aircraft basically up there at Rattray. That was part one. Part two, we moved around and Rattray closed down when we left. Part two was the Operation Flying School. Here we are. Wait a minute, let's get it right here. At St Mirren, commenced OFS Part 2 at St Mirren. Local familiarization, dummy dives. This is dive bombing. We used to come down 60 degree dive, you know. When we used to do 75 degree dives in sea fires, but the 60 degree dive to begin with was bloody awesome, because you pull up, and the 60 degree dive means that you pull up and you're up about 7,000 or 8,000 feet, and you're attacking a ship or something rather down there, and you pull over into a deep drop and go boom and put the nose straight down like that and go boom, and you don't forget that the aircraft, you don't go straight down like that because the aircraft's creating lift, so you're doing this all the time, and you're measuring that. So 60 degree dive is a bloody steep dive. In fact, it was so steep that on this course there, around about here, we'd only been there for a short time, one of the pilots, you can get mesmerized, because you're going straight the way down like this, and you've got to keep an eye. You know, you're started up about 7,000 or 8,000 feet, but you know the ground's coming up bloody quickly, and you've got to start pulling out at the right time. A fellow called Hodge, was another friend of mine, waited a bit too long, and when he pulled out to stop crashing into the earth, he pulled the wings off his aircraft, just the outside wings. He went straight in, bunk. And there's another one that went. Fatalities, you know, were about 10% of the crews, and in fact, it would be until I left the Navy. Even when I was flying scimitars, I lost one of my pilots. He ejected and broke both legs when he ejected because of the ejection seat problem, and he was landed in Borneo. Landed in the sea and was picked up by a helicopter, and he died because he didn't have. He would have died because of the renal failure, because he didn't have the right equipment at the Naval Hospital in Singapore base. I tell you, that's another story.
Was there at that time, though, almost an acceptance that there would be losses that you'd experienced right from the start of your
career? Yeah, you knew that.
That you got used to.
10% of the pilots, In my experience, on operational flying from an aircraft carrier in peacetime, would die because of the some sort of failure, either bad flying or weather conditions, or for instance, you could have a catapult failure if you're being toosted off the catapult for one reason or another, and you go under the ship. Now, that's a difficult thing, but you stand a good chance of living through that. One guy I know, who's now an admiral, admiral in the middle, he used to be my assistant at one time, but he did better than I did. He was the captain of Hermes during the Falklands War. And Lynn Middleton twice had failures and went under the aircraft carrier. Incredible. So, but he was lucky to get away with it.
But accidents throughout training were common then? Accidents throughout training were common, were they, as well?
Oh, yes. Accidents, of course, happened all the time. Yeah, that's right. The wives, I pity the wives, you see. You speak to my wife about it, it was always biting their fingers, because they never knew, you know, who would be the next person to receive a telephone call, etc. It was a dicey business. It probably still is. I mean, these people, you've only got to think about these people working in Afghanistan at the moment, you know. It's a dreadful business for the wives when you're waiting. And those are very brave guys, the chaps who are dealing with these explosive devices and all the rest of it. But that's what we used to lose in peacetime, 10%.
And in a steep dive, that sort of 60-degree dive that you're in, is the sensation that you almost feel you're vertical?
Oh, yeah, you're looking down there like this, and you're not quite going vertical. In the sea fire, we used to do it 75-degree dives, and that was even worse, because you feel you're over the vertical. it's the only thing that was effective was greatly effective, used during the Second World War by the Americans and ourselves, but they had better dive bombers, I think. We had dive bombers which weren't really good, with the Blackburn things and things like that. We couldn't really sink the German battleships properly. But they are the only things that are really effective against battleships and things like that.
And pulling out of a dive like that, is there a possibility that you could black out at the bottom?
Only if you were pulling really hard, and you could black out. But you could probably get away with that, because as long as you kept on pulling hard, you know, and then easing forward, you get your sight back. Of course, nowadays, they've got G-suits and all the rest of it, which helps enormously. But in those days, you just used to grit your tummy, or do your belt up tight or something or other. Stop all the blood going down to your legs. At any rate, so that was that. So we started flying there at St. Mirren. Now, there's an interesting thing that happened to me, because... there was only my 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We were on an oxygen climb, and we'd been told it was an oxygen climb, and my engine failed, and I had to ditch just off the coast over here by Lundy Island. And I was wearing my Irvine jacket, because there was no heating in the aeroplanes, and we were going up well above 20,000 feet. And it was getting on. Well, it was September. It wasn't too bad. Well, I managed to ditch the aircraft all right, and climbed out of the cockpit, and I could see Lundy Island in the far distance. And I would have been with the formation, and I'd radioed which side I was. But you could very quickly lose sight of each other under those circumstances. And by the time that the leader of the formation received my radio saying that I had an engine failure and I was gliding down, he'd lost sight of me. So I landed on the I'm not quite sure even to this day whether it was the northeast side or the southwest side. But however, they said I'd given the wrong coordinates. I didn't think I had done at the time, but that's what they said. And so I spent about an hour and a half in the water there waiting, and eventually a fellow called Fraser Shotton who was flying a sea fire, came along, and he spotted me, and he dived down over me, waggled his wings, and I waited a bit longer. I was getting a bit cold, so I had a quick pee, which warmed me up my legs. Of course, I was wearing this bloody Irvine jacket, though, don't forget, as well. And whatnot, and the water was cold, and then this sea otter landed, which was the naval the flying boat, sort of thing, a small single engine flying boat, landed and taxied. And the waves were quite bit, really and truly, quite good. And he taxied over towards me, and I did my best to paddle towards him, and eventually I got hold of the side of the aircraft. And two of the crewmen in the back leaned over and helped me up. But, you know, could they get me in that airplane? They couldn't. And I was getting weaker and weaker and weaker all the bloody time. And the reason they couldn't do it was because the bloody Irving jacket had soaked up the flaming water. And it was like a ton weight on me. Eventually, by a supreme effort, I couldn't have managed it again another time. I managed to get myself over the edge, and they pulled me in quickly and topped me down. I was immediately sick because I'd been drinking so much bloody salt water. And they taxied me back. I spent the night in sick bay, and I was flying the next day or something or other.
When you come into to Ditch, what kind of attitude do you take with the aircraft? Is there something that you have to do, a series of...
Well, the only thing you don't do is put the wheels down. So basically speaking, it's just like that. And you lose everything else, and you aim to touch down. Just as if you're landing on the water. Things can go wrong. You can hit a wave at the wrong way, and you can slice up and just dive straight down. I was lucky. I just hit the water. I can remember a great gush of water over the front, as the thing, and the spray was all over the bloody place. And the next thing I knew was the aircraft had come to a stop. The nose was slightly down, and the water was up to my chest, and I just slowly and calmly, I just undid all the belts. I had my dinghy on and my parachute. And disentangle myself, got into the dinghy in the approved fashion, and I was getting into the dinghy when the aircraft just put its nose down and just slid slowly into the water. So I was on my own then, and I pulled myself into the dinghy, finished pulling myself into the dinghy, and I just stayed there and waited, and looking around idly, wondering what the hell was going to happen next, hoping that somebody would come along and zoom me. And it was a long time before. I don't know how long it was, to be perfectly honest, but I didn't look at my watch. But I think it felt like at least an hour, I would have thought. Well, it would have been then, because they had to organise all the aircraft to fly off from St. Nair and get the crews out. And they took a long time before they found me as well. So then, anyway, that's another one of my little episodes.
Is it a useful experience in some respects, in the sense that it gives you the confidence to know that you can perform something like a ditching?
I'm bloody glad it was a firefly and not a sea fire, because the Spitfire had a reputation about being a bloody awful aircraft to ditch. In fact, nearly every one of them went boom straight in. Yeah, you're right there. It gave me confidence in flying this aircraft, and everything went well. Again, there's a luck pace, you know. You can all sorts of things can go wrong at the last bloody minute.
I was thinking as well, obviously, confidence you have then in your own skills, that you know what to do when...
You've been briefed on it. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I had been briefed on all these things. That's one thing the military do teach you. I'm not just talking about the Navy now, but any military service anywhere in the world, I'm sure. Except perhaps some Zimbabwe people who wouldn't bother. But, I mean, no, I take that back, actually. That's a joke. There are undoubtedly somebody who aren't as thorough as we are, but again, I will say that the Fleet Arm prides itself about being one of the premier, well, at least it used to be. I don't know what it's like these days, or there's hardly any of it left. But it was a fantastically good flying organisation. We think we were better than the Royal Air Force. From all respects, from our operations and everything else.
After that had occurred, is there any kind of, I was going to say investigation, but that's probably too strong. Do you have a kind of debrief on what had happened?
Oh, yeah, I had to, I forget exactly. There wasn't anything to write down for me on that one. I don't think so. I don't remember writing down, but I went to my CO and I told him what had happened. Because don't forget, I wasn't a member of the squadron, I was still a student. And I told him what had happened, and they knew what had happened because they knew the damn thing had failed, because they followed me down and they knew I was in the water. So there was not much of a story to tell, really. They just said, what did you do, what did everything like to, I told them, and I described it more or less as I just told you. And after that, let's see what happened after that. I finished 60-degree dive bombing there still. Now, the last flight in the Firefly, in November the 6th, 1946, I was appointed to the 51st Training Air Group up at Royal Naval Air Station Eglinton. It's Northern Ireland. It's now a civil airport near Londonderry. It's a Londonderry airport, in actual fact, these days. And again, you got in the... This is my first solo, written in red, in a well, it was a Seafire, but it's just, you know, a Spitfire thing. That was 1 hour 10. Only problem that went wrong there on that first solo was the fact that the bloody great big engine sitting out in you in the Spitfire, and you had to taxi, had to keep on weaving the aircraft to see where you were with this big engine in front of you. You know, you couldn't see where you couldn't see straight ahead of you. And so it was best we pull the lever to raise the seat up so you were a little bit higher in the cockpit. We took off with the cockpit open, and just in case anything happened, that was the standard procedure. I lined up there on the runway and checked everything, did everything except for one thing. I didn't lower my seat slightly. So as I accelerated along the bloody runway, etc., and I got airborne. And it was a beautiful aeroplane to fly, absolutely superb, light as anything on the touch. And it was moving looking like a charm. But I couldn't get the hood because it banged it. So eventually, I shifted hands. And there's two things you had to do. You had to lever down on the right-hand side, which you raised to raise the undercarriage. And I also had to get hold of the lever to lower the seat a couple of notches. Once that was done, it didn't take long to do, I'm telling you, it took me much less time to do in actual fact than it has taken me to tell you the story now. But I was airborne, I was way up in the sky. I've never been so surprised in all my life. It was a really delightful aircraft to fly, and I'm very fortunate to have flown a large number of hours in this aircraft, including finishing in one of the squadrons up here with the very latest one, the last edition, as it were, of the old Spitfire, which was twice the weight of the original Spitfire. It had contra-rotating propellers. It was a Seafire 47. It was a fantastic aircraft. And we were the first aircraft to get them. And contra-rotating propellers. It had a twin stage, supercharger, and it could fly way above 40,000 feet. But of course, it didn't have pressurized cockpits, and we didn't go above firstly 40,000 feet. I did do it on one occasion, when I tried to do it unpressurized, and I was over down the south of England here, and I remember making a call to the base on the radio, and I hadn't got any breath in my body. I couldn't tell. War. that was it. Christ. And that was true because we're way above the height of Everest, 40,000 feet. I've got it in the book here, some bloody place. Not here. It was too early.